not in this part of the country, but on the other, in the other part of the country, which we don't speak about, where it rains a lot.
Yeah,
and he's a corporate member of the South African Planning Institute. Also, there are seats over there still. Alan's urban development experience includes urban NGO work, particularly with Plan Act, which he helped co-found in 1985, as well as public sector consulting since 1994. He was deputy chairperson, National Development and Planning Commission from 1997 to 2000 in South Africa. Alan has spent time at Yale University, at Queen's University, Institut Universitaire de France, and Université de Paris-10, Nanterre, on several occasions, and is presently the chercheur associé à Centre de Recherche sur l'Habitat, Laboratoire, Architecture, Ville, Urbanisme et Environnement, CNRS, in Paris. His research interests are local government, urban history, city region, changing roles and relationships of public and private sectors and city development, and, of course, suburbia. His present research projects include Think Metropole, Pensez la Métropole, and African Suburbs as a co-investigator in our MCRI. And it is in this context we've asked Alan to speak to us today, and he's going to talk about scope and dimension of African suburbanism. Alan.
Yeah, thank you. You know, there are these other chairs here. You can sort of push them around the corner because they're pretty useless in front of the screen there. Thank you very much, Roger. I'm tempted to give a long introduction to Roger Kyle as well, but I think I'll skip that for today.
It could be embarrassing because I remember distinctly when we met, which was at a swimming pool in Phoenix.
That's correct. Very good. I think the pool was empty, though.
You won't tell.
So hi everybody, thank you very much for coming along, it's very nice of you, and thank you very much for this excellent coincidence that I could put a number of things together in a rather mad 6-day trip to 3 cities in Canada. And thanks especially not only to you, Roger, and other members of supposedly academic and intellectual team, but the people who really are important in running the City Institute and the suburbs project, such as Judy Patlat. And what happened to Sarah? There she is. She's right opposite me. No wonder I can't see her. So thank you very, very much. I'm responsible, together with somebody called Robin Bloch, who, like Roger and some other people, have PhDs from the University of California, Los Angeles. Robin Bloch and I, are responsible for the African spatial, aerial, geographical cluster of things in this global suburbs project. And that's quite something, if you stop to think about it, because, and I know probably you won't be able to read these rather small words, which I just very rapidly created on the plane, but that doesn't really matter. Africa is a continent that has a lot of people living in and around and moving in and out of cities. A lot more people than you probably think about when you wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning. And so one of our starting points does need to be talking about those dimensions of what we might think of as urban, or whether we want to use words like urban at all in the continent that we loosely call Africa with its wonderful Latin name. Now, what is before us is a paper which has just been finished in this very early version. Because the first thing that Robin and I took on responsibility to do is to write a review of, as much as we can manage, write a review of the existing literatures on suburbanisms in Africa, which I don't think anybody has ever really tried to do before. And here we have, in 1.5 spacing, 41 pages to begin with, and about 300 sources that we've referred to. And I don't by any means claim to be comprehensive. And in fact, this paper at this stage hasn't been written by the other co-responsible in the shape of Robin Block, who lives in England. But it's been largely worked up by myself and our graduate research colleague, whose name is Sean Butcher, who you might just about be able to make out over there, who is a very remarkable young woman who was born in Zimbabwe, actually, but lived most of her life in Cape Town and is now a PhD student at the University of Minnesota. And fortunately, this is the 21st century because it's quite possible for us to work collectively on this project, although we are almost literally standing 180 degrees, feet sort of pointing towards each other and heads facing out into opposite parts of the solar system or whatever. And she really needs to be acknowledged here more than anything else. So let me just start by, because I'm not really going to talk very directly to the paper, I'm going to tell you a couple of things about what's in it. I'm sure that Roger and company will make the paper available one way or another to anybody who's keen, but you have to then promise to read and comment on the paper. You don't just get it free of charge, you see. There's work to be done here. So I want to start by talking generally about African cities. I need to do that because although many people here, I'm sure, have spent time, maybe much of their lives in some cases, in cities in Africa, as I indeed have, I was, after all, born in one of them and have lived there most of my life, not all of it, as you've heard. Let's talk about where we are with African cities now. And you know, the very first thing that might come to mind is the African cities that are on everybody's lips at the moment would be Abidjan, if not Benghazi, or those other long-contested Libyan cities like Tobruk, where some of my ancestors were taken into prisoner of war camps by previous armies. You know, we could talk about Benghazi and Tripoli and other cities where contest is violent and armed and extremely dramatic and very, very traumatic for very large numbers of people right now. And I don't want to overstress that image nonetheless, because there it is on the front page of today's newspaper or the first item you'll see on BBC World or whatever it is, Al Jazeera or whichever channel you happen to subscribe to. But I don't want to overstress that image, but we need to bear in mind that there are places that we won't easily be able to choose as case studies in drilling deeper into what is happening in Africa. There are limits, profound limits to what we can do. And yet, there are completely different faces to what we could say about cities in Africa, and that's why I chose this particular image to begin. This is one of the world's, probably, many claims like this are made every hour of every day, but this is probably an image from one of the world's fastest growing cities. It's Luanda, the capital city of Angola. And Angola, as you know, is a country in which war has prevailed for most of my life, let alone most of the lives of most Angolans. Some people in Angola have practically never known a condition other than war. So clearly, the history of a city like Luanda is going to have a lot to do with that. And Luanda also has a very long history. We can go a lot further back if we wish to. And remember that Luanda, like some other ports along the West African coast, have some of their original economic growth rooted in the export of people from Africa in chains to other parts of the world, or to other parts of Africa, for that matter. So this is a long and difficult history, which involves, in the case of Luanda, 500 years of Portuguese colonialism. It's a very long stretch, because Luanda is a very long colonized piece of the African coast. Not all are the same. And yet, looking at an image of a city under construction, you can just about, in the bright lights here, you can see the construction cranes and so on. That image is meant to tell you, this is a city which is bursting with new investment. This is a city which is springing out of the ground. This is a city which is repaving the sidewalks. This is a city which is doing stuff right now, like many cities on other continents, particularly in all those diversities we call Asia. So it's like that in some respects. And of course it also has other zones. This indeed is a picture which shows part of the, if you like, CBD, the historical core of Luanda. This is where a small settlement existed, probably before the Portuguese arrived. I don't know that history very well, but certainly throughout the Portuguese colonial period and after. And yet if we go some kilometers away from there, you don't actually have to go very far. You will come into terrain in Luanda, which local people are likely, I'm not saying absolutely certainly, but local people are likely to say, well, I live in a place with a name, and they will give you the name of the area, the quarter, the quartier, the French word, the bairro, you might say, in various versions of Portuguese. And here they would probably say, I live in a museque, because that's a term that's used to describe the kind of place that you see here. And there seems to be something to do with the deep red earth of Luanda, which has to do with why that name is used, because as people who have limited resources, by and large, have created settlements that look a little like the picture you're seeing here, by and large, the red earth is exposed, and that's a term that tends to hang on. But not all the areas from 5 kilometers to 15 to 20 to 25 kilometers from the first picture I showed you in Luanda look like this. Because, of course, there are other kinds of environments as well. And some of them look like this. This picture is taken about 20 kilometers south of downtown, if you want to call it that, that old Manhattan term, downtown Luanda. And it is clearly an environment which doesn't have the same built form as the museke you saw in the last image. It's something different. It's something very new. And we could loosely call it a middle to upper income, largely residential neighborhood. Being built, not so different from some of the towers of Toronto, 15, 20, 25, 30 kilometers from the original York, if we want to put it that way, here. So this is a complicated place. Surprise. Cities are always complicated places. And here we have places that maybe people who have nice jobs with the oil companies or the many, many small companies that provide sophisticated services to the oil companies or to the Angolan government or the multilateral organization staff or the new investors or the people who are working on behalf of rather speculative types of investors who may be of origins from every continent might be found establishing themselves, renting or purchasing new places, and also perhaps creating new environments of what we could loosely call economic activity, by which I mean not the residential activity, which is definitely an economic activity in its own right, but other things, and because there'll be shops, and maybe associated with the shops there'll now be offices, and maybe people will find that commuting into the center of Luanda on a two-lane road, a survival of colonial military investment with a traffic jam that makes things that you might experience between central Toronto and York seem like absolute heaven by comparison. Maybe people stop doing that and they shift their office if the internet connections are good and the Wi-Fi works and the cell phone connections are fabulous and the satellite phones are no longer needed at the highly expensive rates that they cost. So there's a tale of, if you like, a slightly extreme African city. You can reflect on the kinds of points that I've made. Yes, it's a place with these complicated, long, and often very oppressive histories. Yes, it's a place with being located within the theater of war, you might say, in over a very, very long time. It bears lots of the features of colonialism, and it bears also many features of the end of the 20th and certainly the beginning of the 21st century, not least the fact that the price of a barrel of oil coming from the oil fields not far away is pushing in the direction of $150. So there you are. Now that's not the whole story of cities in Africa by any means. And let's just think about the extent of the issue that we're talking about. I've chosen, because I was born just south of the Tropic of Capricorn, I've used the other tropic as a line. The Tropic of Cancer, which runs across Africa roughly here, roughly there. So I don't like the phrase sub-Saharan Africa for reasons that are probably pretty obvious as soon as I say the word. So I'm talking about Africa, largely south of the Tropic of Cancer. And that includes an immense amount of diversity. There's Luanda, which is minimal in size according to this particular representation. And you can see a number of things. First of all, at the moment, I'm not really, although in a minute I'll break my own rules and I'll do this, I'm not really talking about the cities of the Maghreb, an extremely urbanized part of Africa. That should be obvious just from even this map. I'm not talking about the cities of the Mashrek, stretching Libya, Egypt, and through, with no real boundary between Africa and Asia, obviously. And in fact, exactly the inverse in all sorts of social respects. I'm not really going to talk about those, but they're part of the picture. And some of the same issues are clearly going to present themselves, the sorts of things that within the larger project we're hoping to begin to explore in more tension with each other. You can see that a lot of Africa's population, even in this sketch, lives here. West Africa is really the heavily populated part of Africa. That's what we would normally think of as West Africa, roughly Dakar, not even Saint Louis, as far as the cities of Cameroon or Gabon. So I'm not going to spend much time today talking much about those, but clearly it's very... Whoopsie. Sorry, that's me and my computer. It'll come back, I hope. So I'm not going to spend much time talking about West Africa. I'll just remember to keep it a bit more live here. I come from here, so I'm going to talk a little bit about this part of the world. And because I've spent a lot more time in Tanzania than any other African country, I'll tend to talk about Tanzania, which also, unlike Angola, is a very peaceful country. It's possibly the most peaceful country in Africa. And it's on the Indian Ocean side of Africa. Sometimes I call this the Afro-Asian Sea, you know, because that helps us to understand what it's about. So we have all that diversity, and we also have, you know, the dimensions of the population. These figures are, I presume, going to tell us something in thousands. It's a rather odd table, but it's telling you that in what UN Habitat here, because this is a table from the State of African Cities report of UN Habitat, it tells us that in 2010, about 323 million people, so they claim, live in cities in Africa, whatever that kind of claim might be. A bit more than a third of the population of sub-Saharan so-called Africa. 323 million people. That's a lot of people. I leave it to you to think about how many people live in cities in the United States and Canada added together and compare that with the number of people living in cities in Africa, which is only just a bit more than a third of the population of this part of Africa. And to think about what that means for the future. We're not competing here with India or China or Indonesia or Pakistan for that matter, but nevertheless, we are making an interesting point that a big chunk of those people who spend a lot of their lives in cities in the world are now people who do that on the African continent. When I was born, which happens to be just about 60 years ago, that absolutely was not the case. This is a change in much less than my lifetime, in fact. Is a one place we're using the four-letter word fact wouldn't be too bad. So we are talking about something of substantial significance to humanity taken as a whole. There's a dramatic claim. Okay, now in our paper, you can't read that, so it's useless. I'm sorry, it's just my own stupidity sitting on a plane yesterday. In our paper, we try to review very substantial literature, but tiny literature by comparison with what you can read on North American cities. tiny by comparison with what I would be able to read on Chinese cities if I read Chinese signs, either Cantonese, Mandarin, Fujian, or whatever else, all the same signs. I don't. African literature, nevertheless, is a lot. It's big. There's a lot of material there, and it's been growing up for a long time. And just to run down the headings, because this is just a list of the headings in our review, I'm going to start a little bit by showing some more examples. I'm going to talk about this difficulty when I... That's why I'm skeptical. You can hear my tone when I say people living in the cities of Africa. What on earth does that mean? Because the population of African cities is notoriously fluid. This is not unique to Africa. Try Mexico or India for comparisons. But it's particularly important in Africa. We're going to talk a little bit about how the suburbs, interesting word, come to be what they are in Africa and how they are talked about, what names are used, what words are used. I'm going to use a vignette in the paper. I'm going to use various vignettes, not the one that's in the paper, which is one from Bulawayo in Zimbabwe, to introduce some of the elements of the idea of suburbs. Traverse a bit of history and then talk about different kinds of zones, different kinds of spaces, different new urban spaces, if you like, which I will tend to want to describe as new theatres of performance of life. What are these new theatres that are emerging? I've shown you a couple in Luanda already. These are new theatres of the performance of life. What are these places like? And we have to categorise them. We don't have to be totally Foucauldian to accept that categorisation and classification are always really impossible, but nevertheless, these categories, of course, overlap. Talk about the moving urban frontier. Talk about the spaces which concentrate new economic investment and activities. Talk about public housing as something apparently quite different. The big attempts at various times in various parts of Africa to create townships, we call them in South Africa, and what's related to that. It's not unique to South Africa. We'll talk about zones of middle and upper income residence. And that'll force us back to looking at the relationship between what we sometimes loosely call the formal and the informal, because these things do not relate in anything like certain ways. And we then talk about the older suburbs, which may once have been formal and now not be, or the reverse, and look at what is changing in places that have been on the landscape for longer than some of the spots I've already shown you. I'm not really going to talk about government and governance and democracy, although that's an area that needs a lot more development. And I'm probably going to say very little about culture, about life, about daily life, but I am going to emphasize the sense that there are new spaces, new theaters of performance of life in the suburbs. And the paper begins with a quote from Paul Jenkins, who's a remarkable scholar. He's an architect professionally by origin. He's Irish by origin, which is probably important to know. And he lives in Scotland, but he lived in Mozambique for 14 years. And he worked at one point as a key planner in the city of Maputo. And a few years ago, he wrote an article with a quote which reads as follows: "Urban centers are often defined by what they are not. And indeed, it is usually easier to get people to agree on what is clearly an urban area, or clearly not one, than what can be the urban-rural interface, or a front line within this, in what is usually termed, his phrase, the peri-urban area. Different modes of analysis will result in no agreement on whether an area is actually urban or rural. In addition, the formal or official definition is often arbitrary, usually based on the geographical definition of some particular territory as urban for political or administrative reasons." Now, we could say that right around the world, but it has a particular resonance in Africa. Take this scene. Is this okay? If we turn these lights out, maybe it would be a little clearer. What do you think, Roger? Does that make sense? Not too bad. Yeah, that's great. This is Dar es Salaam. This is Dar es Salaam, obviously viewed from not a tower that controls people's minds, such as you have on the lakefront in Toronto. I presume that's what it's there for. But this is a landscape taken from a plane. And right away, it's showing you different things that are happening at what we might loosely call the moving urban frontier. I can just use the cursor, actually. There's the bay on which the harbour, a very nice harbour, was chosen by the German colonists in the 1880s, 1890s, to establish a new capital for the relatively new colony. The original capital's at Bagamoyo, further north. And they did that because it was an easier place to have ships, and which were now ironclad vessels, and to build a railway line into the interior. Very important features of what one did in the 1890s, I guess. But over time, over the 120-odd years that Dar es Salaam has been here, it's grown rather a lot. You can get a sense of its scale. Probably has a population of about 4 million people, whatever that means today. And here at the moving urban frontier, you can see areas that are already there, and then somebody else who's got a piece of land here who's decided to do some what you might loosely call planning and cut it up with a regular kind of pattern of roads, which is a bit different from what other people did in this area, and maybe different again from other things that you'd find elsewhere in the urban environment. So we find that idea of the moving urban frontier a powerful one from which to begin. For discussion, we don't claim that this is the only way to go, but we find that that's an interesting place to start. And this picture, also taken by a colleague from an aircraft, is taken south of Dar es Salaam because it's in Maputo, it's in Mozambique. And it's showing an area which had no legal formality when it was originally created. It was laid out by people on the ground, landowners and others, who created something relatively regular. They cut up pieces of land. I haven't got a closer shot of that. They cut up pieces of land, you know, in a pretty rectangular kind of pattern, and people have done what they've needed to do in a variety of ways in those areas, very much at the moving urban frontier. This, by contrast, looks quite different. This is the moving urban frontier of another very fast-growing city in Africa. It's called Tunis. Because Tunisia, although a small country with a population of only, what, about 11 million people or something like that, Tunis concentrates 3 or 4 million of those people, depending, again, on how you define the city, maybe more, big proportion of the Tunisian population. And one of the reasons why you've just had a revolution in Tunisia is because of the growth of the middle class, whatever that middle class means. Let's just leave it as a very loose phrase. And where does that growing middle class live? Well, a lot of it lives in these, just inside, if you like, the moving urban frontier. In environments that are built apparently much more formally than the kinds of environments that you just saw from the air in the Mozambican case. So we have both, because you won't, this is again a little closer up in the Tunisian case, some of it could be in Toronto, couldn't it? It doesn't look absolutely that different. So this is a very important phenomenon related in part to the demography of Tunisia, and the revolution may be partly related to whether or not the people who now find themselves living in these places can pay the rent, buy the house, actually have a job. What's happening to the Tunisian economy in the current context of a drying up of investment from the Gulf is one of the things that's happened in the Tunisian economy. And while most of it is very formal, you do find little bits and pieces, like at the very bottom of this image, that are not like that, that are a little different. So you have a mix of different kinds of things going on even in that environment, at the urban frontier. Let's take a look at a map of Dakar. This is about, that's about 30 kilometers across this largely urbanized zone, divided into a lot of different communes, a lot of different areas of government. And at the edge of Dakar, in a sense, Rufiske is becoming more like Pikine, made famous by a variety of authors on Africa. This is the peninsula, by the way. This is Cap Vert here. This is the peninsula that runs into the Atlantic Ocean. It's kind of why Dakar is there. This is the famous island, or the infamous island of Gorée. So this place has a moving urban frontier, beginning to expand out into previously uncharted territory, apparently, according to that map. But of course, it's not that uncharted, because Dakar is intimately connected to other parts of Senegal and indeed along the railway line, made famous in a wonderful film and novel called God's Bits of Wood by a very marvelous Senegalese writer and filmmaker. You can follow along that route to another very important place in the life of Senegal, which is the city of Touba. You know the city of Touba? Next time you stop on the street corner in Toronto or Johannesburg or New York or, for that matter, Dakar, and buy yourself a cap because the sun is hot and is shining on your head, you are likely to buy it from a Senegalese trader who adheres to a Muslim association which is headquartered in Touba and which is global in its associational effects. You can go read other people's books on that subject. And everything between Dakar and Touba is becoming, if you like, incorporated into a moving urban frontier. That's a pretty standard pattern in many parts of the world. Very dramatic example of that phenomenon I'll show you a little later on from Kampala. But let's turn to Accra in Ghana, which will be the site of one of our case studies because Robin is working there with colleagues. And in the case of Accra, to some extent, the expansion of the city is related to the roads. Tema, the port, was once really separated from Accra. This is a distance of about 20 kilometers from Accra, a bit more than 20 kilometers from Accra to Tema. This side of Accra, the western side of Accra, was really, this was rural village environment until, you know, maybe 10 years ago. But gradually things have stretched along the road and spread out from that road. And if we drive along that road, you will see images of very active life taking place in that environment with all sorts of new spaces for urban action. That's literally driving along the road, heading out to the west of Dakar. A very new environment. We could go back to Dar es Salaam and we could see the same kinds of patterns. Very often it's the roads leading out of the city that have been important as part of the ways of occupying space. And here's my example from Kampala, Lake Victoria, world's second biggest freshwater lake, etc., etc. Lake Victoria is in the south on this picture at the bottom. Here is Kampala, more or less mapped by UN Habitat. Here is Entebbe, where some nasty things have happened in history, but which is where the main airport is because of the flatter land next to the lake. And you cannot drive along this road and see anything that resembles countryside any longer. In fact, the key economic activity that takes place along this road is furniture manufacture and selling. And if you want to buy really interestingly carved furniture and so on, you'll head off to that road. Okay, now none of this happens in isolation, because Africa, as Richard Grant's very good book, actually, I must say, on Dakar, which is about the globalization of Accra, did I say Dakar? Of Accra in Ghana. The globalization of life in Accra, what that means. Very, very good book. It's a very good way of illustrating how reconnection, new connection, and reproduction of connection around the globe, not only in Touba and Dakar, but in Accra and every other African city, has entirely shifted the ways in which people not only perform their daily lives, but think about who they are in relation to the world. And this picture, which I've just taken out of a French magazine just for fun, is one way of illustrating how that's happening. It is happening in large part very individually in associational connections between people who may move back and forth between, say, Dakar and New York, but it's also happening in a relatively small number of major global corporations which exercise enormous amounts of influence and power and make very substantial investments in African urban environments. So that's an area that we haven't yet explored in the paper. And what this map shows you, very simply just lifted from an article about this very fact the other day when I was reading a magazine, is it shows how the group called Bolloré, have you heard of the group called Bolloré? It's a very, very important French conglomerate owned by somebody who happens to be a very close personal buddy of the President of France at the moment. And he has acquired contracts to run the container ports on all of the locations that you see in that map. And in each case, that's come partly for the apparently very good reason that the group Bolloré promises to invest more money in the local ports and the related infrastructure and maybe new buildings. We're not talking about the private bank accounts of any of the local politicians here at all. So this has to do with what is driving along those patterns, but it's not a substitute for or exclusive of individual forms of reconnection to the globe, which, whether you're in Tunis, can be seen in these amazing assemblages of French corporations with their use of Arabic writing next to long-established mosques. Or I like this one because doesn't that, you know, where is this shopping mall? Where is the plan with the, where is the key to where you will find your favorite shop? You see that sign at any closed shopping mall you might go into, whether it's in Montreal or Vancouver or in Johannesburg or probably in Mumbai or in various other parts of the world. This one happens to be in Accra. It's from the mall in Accra, which is called, no doubt appropriately, Accra Mall, but which is close to the airport and about 12 kilometers, 15 kilometers from the center of Accra. So really what I've turned to here is emphasizing the significance of very, very large amounts of new, often external, not always external, new large amounts of investment in apparently very formal activities in the ports, in transport infrastructure, in shopping malls, in office buildings, as you see here along the zone nord-est of the Lac in the Lac Nord in Tunis. And that, of course, reaches its height to come for a first time to my own city of birth, etc., which is Johannesburg. That phenomenon can be seen more clearly in Johannesburg than anywhere else, but that doesn't mean to say that it's exclusive to Johannesburg. And if you look at the literature on Johannesburg, you will immediately run into an elemental fact, well known to people in other parts of the world, that those investments are related to extraordinarily complex changes in the meaning of centrality in the cities that we're talking about. Whereas Accra once had very clearly one or two or three major centers of urban life, a little different for different people possibly, but in close proximity to one another, pretty clear in everybody's mind, that's where you had to go to get stuff done, to transact business, to deal with the state, to meet foreigners, whatever the case might have been, to meet people foreign in the sense of just being migrants from outside the city. And so investments like this is close to where I now live in Johannesburg, it's only about 6 or 7 kilometers from downtown Johannesburg. Nevertheless, it's one of these investments that's had a major effect in changing the nature of life. And a well-known South African author who's really a literati person called Sarah Nuttall, who writes often with her husband Bashir Mbembe, has written about this exact place, which is called the Zone, as you may be able to see in the sign there, and about the performances of life by teenagers at the Zone and how much change that means in urban life or in South African life. And that relates to a number of issues that may come to your mind when I mention the name of my own country. And if you want to look for change, where do you go? Well, in a sense, what Sarah Nuttall is saying, go to the Zone and you'll see what's actually happening. Okay, so there I've traversed some of the sections of our review without really referring to very many of the authors. And I want to continue to point out that some of these investments that are being made are continuing to create what we might loosely call industrial suburbs. They're creating less centered environments where there is productive activity taking place. And I would say one of the most uncertain areas of the future of African cities, a personal claim, possibly including the northern ones, certainly most of the southern ones, certainly the ones that I know, is what is the future of that investment in productive, industrial, manufacturing types of activity? Because we know that in Kuala Lumpur, or in Hanoi, or Ho Chi Minh City, or many Indian cities, not least Bangalore, not to mention Chinese cities like Wuhan, that the creation of new zones of industry in relatively decentered spaces is extraordinarily important to what has happened in those cities. But we're not so clear about what's happening in those respects right here in North America, or for that matter in a large part of Africa. So there's very little literature on that subject. Another jump cut, those industrial areas tend to mean big wage or salary paid, proletarian workforces, to use nice old-fashioned terminology. Where do those people live? Well, in the period of growth of some of those industrial suburbs in Nairobi, even in Lusaka on a very small scale, in Bulawayo, in Johannesburg, in Maputo, in Luanda, in Accra, in Lagos, all of these cities have phenomena of that kind. Well, one of the things that colonial authority, or a type of colonial authority like apartheid government in South Africa did, was to create public housing estates to house the large workforce. And right here in Dar es Salaam, that's what this picture shows, here's a public housing estate in Dar es Salaam. It happens to have been built at the end of the colonial period, while the British were still the colonial authorities, just before 1960, and some of it was continued after that. And in the so-called socialist period in Tanzania, public housing continued to be an important trope, because one of the big partners of the otherwise ostracized Tanzanian government of the wonderful man Julius Nyerere, Mwalimu, meaning teacher in Kiswahili, one of the things that happened under the ostracism of his government was that he had few friends, and one of his groups of friends were Eastern Germans. And just now, I'll show you, in a minute or two, I'll show you pictures of the kind of housing that was built with Eastern German support, with German Democratic Republic support in that rather peculiar period of the 1970s and 1980s. Whilst in South Africa, the high modernism that's associated with, or in Zimbabwe, or to some extent in Zambia, most definitely in Namibia, to some extent in Botswana, a little bit in Angola, and in the West African British colonies, and sometimes in some of the French ones, a high modernism impressed itself upon the landscape in public housing estates of one form or another. This is a recent picture, but it captures what happened in the 1950s and 1960s, especially in South Africa, with the mass scale of this stuff. And in South Africa, one used to laugh when I was, let's say, 15 years old or 12 years old or something, at the very idea that you would call the townships, as these spaces came to be known, suburbs. Whereas in Zimbabwe, in 1980, when Robert Mugabe became the president of Zimbabwe, and we all went to Zimbabwe to celebrate that fact, new terminology was introduced. And areas like this, townships in South Africa, came to be called high-density suburbs in Zimbabwe, and they still are today. So in Zimbabwe we have low-density suburbs and high-density suburbs. And the paper, when introduces the vignette of Bulawayo, talks about that. These places are not static. So you can take a very dramatic example from Soweto, which is obviously the best-known township name from South Africa. And in this picture, you can see how the original, what we call matchbox type of house, built around 1960 in this area, which is called Jabulani in Soweto, this type of matchbox may have been completely transformed into something like that. So the landscape itself, and that's a critical element. What has happened to one or two or three generation old suburbs of one sort or another as time has passed? And there's a closer, that's one of my favorites actually, there's a closer image because it very clearly parallels. That's the way the house was built, asbestos roof and all, and here's the way that a 1990s 2000s person has completely altered that environment. One of the people we quote in the paper, a very well-known historian called Bill Freund, uses a word which I've introduced in a slightly different way, and he describes this as pseudo-suburbia. Well,
Alan, sorry, was that Bulawayo?
No, that's from Soweto. That's from Soweto. But you, on a much smaller scale, you could see the same sorts of things. Less in Bulawayo, more in Harare, for example, yeah. This is back to Dar es Salaam. This is the East German-inspired public housing of the late 1970s, before the changes took place in Tanzania, and I suppose before the decline of the East German economy. So these things are not restricted to South Africa. That's the point that I'm making. They have a much greater importance in Namibia or South Africa, to some extent Zimbabwe, than elsewhere. but they're there in the Congo, they're there in Zambia, they're there in Kenya, they're there in Tanzania, and in a variety of other countries. And it's something that not a lot has been written about. It's a very important area because a lot of people live in these spaces. Then there's the more standard idea of suburbia, South African style, rapidly expanding, largely for middle or higher income people. Same phenomenon exists in other cities in Africa, but they look a bit different. This is, if you like, the equivalent in Dakar. And as you see, there's a little bit of interpenetration of different ways of living and being in this picture. And these older areas are subject to all sorts of transformations. Some of them may go in a more, and I'm not clear at all about the variables involved, but some of them may go more in the direction of gentrification, if you like. Why not use that term after all? And others may go in a different direction. And this aerial picture has its own beauty of part of the coastline of Dakar. Perhaps captures a sense of how a less formal, an informalization, in almost a sense of the opposite of a gentrification, may be taking place in some environments. Which raises the whole question of what on earth does this formality, informality stuff mean? And I like this picture, which is from Accra, because it captures the fact that there's no point in having a one-line analysis of what these things are about. What is the business which is going on in this particular informal business environment? Well, I will leave that to your imagination. But let's just say that many different elements of life are likely to interpenetrate, shall we say, as life proceeds in environments of this kind. And that won't be unique, certainly in African cities, maybe not anywhere else, to areas that we traditionally speak of as informal areas. Cairo would give us, probably, although I don't know it well, would give us overwhelming examples. So let's turn to Africa's best known, totally informal city, which wasn't always, which is Kinshasa. Second biggest Francophone city in the world, one might wish to say. Unknown size of population, 7 million, 9 million. How on earth would you ever know? Viewed from afar, in a sense, it has the modern city appearance that grew up in the 1950s and 1960s, including after independence, the famous independence of the Congo, the 30th of June 1960, and the dreadful events that followed. And the result of some of those dreadful events is obviously and immediately actually visible in the foreground. So we don't only have an informalization. In some cases, we will have an abandonment, a complete abandonment of an existing urban environment. But I wouldn't wish to overstress that image. And I would wish to urge caution in pursuing the images we've come, Sean and I, certainly probably Robin, to the conclusion that pursuing the image of endless development crisis, of endless appalling abandonment of old, well-serviced environment, that these images are more or less completely unhelpful in comprehending what is actually changing within these African environments. Because, and here's another slightly longer view of Kinshasa, because of the enormous complexity of what is taking place on the ground. If it's really the case that everything in Kinshasa is informal and clandestine, how on earth will you ever manage to account for the continuation of life in that environment? Well, we'll leave those questions aside and incite you to read a journal partly edited not far from here called the International Journal of Urban and Regional Research, and a recent article in the March issue by Ananya Roy, which picks up on exactly those questions, and I think quite creatively, but with limits, tries to explore, explore the limits of inverting the idea of crisis. So, but let's leave it at that. And this is a limit in our own text, that we haven't yet brought back our readings of some of these empirical studies, mostly empirical studies, partly conceptual studies of what we might broadly call, and I'll come back to that word in a moment, suburbs in Africa. I'll close in a couple of minutes and I'll come back to that question. And we haven't yet really succeeded in relating those issues to where we are in the debate about the meanings of what is happening in the more general sense. Okay, so with the kinds of changes that have been going on in the variety of cities that I've described, like Bangkok in the 1970s, some of the consequences are radical changes in the costs of doing things and of being in the city. And congestion is one of those results. I already used the congestion trope in relation to why certain kinds of changes are taking place in the theatres of urban life in Luanda. And this is simply a picture taken out of the window of a taxi on the way from the airport to a hotel in Accra. Very easy to do. It's not always like that. But the costs of accessing the old centralities of Accra in Ghana have been radically changed, partly simply by the volume of foreign investment that's arrived in the country, also because of the volume of connection between Ghanaian households in Accra, Ghanaian households elsewhere in Ghana and elsewhere in West Africa, including Nigeria and until recently Côte d'Ivoire, and Ghanaian households in New York, Toronto, Montreal, London, Johannesburg, or wherever else. So a very radical change in the way in which the urban economy runs is clearly underway. And that has particular consequences for transformations of older, relatively established, whether rich or poor, formal or informal, doesn't really matter. It has profound consequences for older parts of the urban environment. And a key consequence is that spatial expansion, urban spatial expansion, comes to mean not necessarily the moving urban frontier with all those powerful images from which I could begin, but urban spatial expansion going up. And you find that happening in every African city in one way or another in extraordinarily powerful and dramatic ways. And this has been seen on other continents, obviously, and is being seen. So here is a simple example from Accra. I don't know who the architect is, and I'm not commenting on what I think of the design. Sometimes it takes place over a long period. It may appear to be stalled, but then the process picks up again. This might be in the conversion of once upon a time shack areas in Nairobi to concrete built tenement buildings, some of which fall over from time to time. Maybe it leads in the longer run to things that could happen in a South African city like Johannesburg or Durban or Cape Town, where there are long-standing, very, very dense high-rise areas. Reminds me, we forgot to talk about the National Film Board earlier on. Excuse my digression, people, but we have to talk about that. This is Hillbrow in Johannesburg. But if we go back to one of my favorite cities, rather obviously, which is Dar es Salaam, here's the way the urban environment has expanded over, let's say, the post-independence period, roughly speaking, from roughly the mid-1960s for a generation or more. But as you see, as you focus on this picture, you begin to pick out a few spots where something a bit high-rise is taking place. And as you zoom in, you can see, actually, there's quite a bit of this happening down on the ground. These older areas are now subject to very substantial conversion. And it may be hotels, it may be offices, it may be apartments. So these older areas are changing. And one of the things that's changing also is a lot of people are making a lot of money out of those changes. And so within what was once a totally informal and apparently very poor, a barefoot area, if you like, lo and behold, we now also have mansions appearing. Well, that's a long-standing phenomenon, but becoming more significant. And if we go to the most dramatic examples, this is the kind of house which used to predominate in a fairly, really, we would traditionally say, central part of Dar es Salaam, a Swahili house or a set of Swahili houses of this kind. Right behind it, whoopsie, is the kind of conversion that's been going on in this area. And that, colleagues, has all taken place within the last dozen years. This is the area called Kariakul in Dar es Salaam. And if you want to know what the origins of the name Kariakul are and you don't know, all you have to do is ask along the way or think about it and remember the history of colonialism and conflict between different colonial masters in places like Tanganyika in the past. Okay, so what I'm saying about Kariakul is one of the most dramatic cases, like some of the Nairobi cases in the whole of Africa, but it's not unique. A conversion from a particular kind of segregated, semi-suburban environment, might even be called a high-density suburb in Zimbabwe today. My goodness, the density question has dramatically exploded here. Okay, and sometimes that's done formally. So here in Accra, we have the city you know, desperately trying to claim a case for planning out towards the airport, Accra Mall areas. What is the future, I guess, is really the question. And how are people writing and thinking about the future? In the case, for example, this is zoomed out from the earlier picture I showed you of Maputo. Here we are about 15 kilometers from the old Portuguese settlement of Lourenço Marques, what's now called, or long called, the Cidade Cimenti in Maputo, the concrete city, the serviced part of the city. And you can see that there's a lot of recent investment when you get closer down to the ground in these areas. And so I guess the question is, what's the future of economic activity? What's the future of the density of economic activity? What's the future of the density of the urban built environment in places of that kind? Even as Michel Agier, that wonderful French anthropologist, points out, even the refugee camps become the suburbs of some African cities and go down the path of becoming something. This is taken from the cover of his book, which is on exactly that subject, the refugee camp as city or as part of the city. Okay, so I need to stop. I could show you a billion other pictures, of course, but let me summarize what we've found so far in this rather scattered presentation for today by saying, we've found in traversing this literature that for the moment we're going to concentrate our thinking around three things that I've obviously emphasized as I've proceeded. One, the moving edge. How do we comprehend the moving edge, which is where most of the literature is focused? Is it useful to apply terms like suburb in English, suburbio in Portuguese, banlieue in French, or any other variety? Is the periurban a term? Richard asked me this question earlier. Is the periurban a term that somebody on the ground would actually use who lives in some of these areas? And the answer is yes, because some of the professionals who teach planning at the universities in cities like Accra and Dar es Salaam live in exactly these kinds of places. But beyond them and their immediate neighbors and family members, perhaps not. So there's a whole question of what terms we used. But we don't want to get bogged down in the very simplistic semantics, because there's not much signification in the real sense of semantics attached to those terms. But rather, we do feel that a lot of the literature is there, and we do need to ask questions about meaningful types, meaningful difference, meaningful similarity around those moving frontiers of the city. This may be where we want to begin the discussion, and we need to ask questions about how those moving frontiers of African cities may or may not be similar to or different from those of India, of China, of Riyadh, of Bahrain, of Istanbul, or of Toronto, for that matter. So we think that that's a crucial area around which to focus. We're not quite clear how. We think that change in these older suburbs, as I've called them, whether it's the public housing estate type, the township type, or the old informal type, or the old, apparently what the Zimbabweans would call the low-density suburbs, we think that the rapid processes of change in those areas are absolutely crucial. This is something my colleague Robin is particularly interested in. And lastly, we think that conceptually, the meaning of centrality in the city may be emerging from the pages of some of the literature that we've looked at, but explorations of meanings of centrality in people's life histories, meanings of centrality in daily life, changed meanings of centrality in daily life at one sort of, if you like, anthropological end of the spectrum, through to what centrality means for investors who may be coming from Beijing or Shanghai or Hong Kong, what centrality means for all sorts of different categories of people, and of course how the question of centrality relates to the political questions, the relationship between the city and the state, the relationship between the city and the possibilities of democracy, the relationship between, and that's where I guess I'd really like to end, because at least we can see in the recent events in Africa, you know, you may be of the kind of third international persuasion that thinks that Laurent Gbagbo's political party is a member of the Socialist International, and therefore he's the guy to be defended in in Abidjan conflict. There certainly are people in the Socialist Party in France who think that. There are others who may be of a similar persuasion who say, no, but Ouattara is just a friend of Sarkozy's. This is Francafrique on the march as usual. Or there may be other ways of analysing what is going on, and one may wish to defend the idea of Ouattara as the elected president. And if we do that, then we might want to have a close look at the suburbs of Abidjan and think about how and why it is that people contemplate from those different spaces, whether it's from Abobo or from Kokodi or from Trècheville, or let alone in the old centrality of Plateau in Abidjan, why it is that these people appear in the political firmament in the way that they do, how people form their relations with each other around the importance of those questions, and how those ideas of political centrality are changing. So I'll finish by using those dramatic, perhaps unfair examples from Abidjan to raise those issues. But I do have a sense that that question of the ways in which the relationship between people and the state, the relationship between the city and the state, are being refracted through some of the developments in the suburbs, we would very, very loosely say presently, I think we're going to find that we may have something very new emerging, as Caesar once said, from Africa. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Alan, for this fascinating talk. We have about 20 minutes.
Yeah, it's probably been a bit long, for which I apologize.
Richard. Richard happens to know Alan, but if people could quickly introduce themselves when they speak.
I'm Richard Harris. I'm an urban historical geographer from McMaster University.
He's the person I've known for the longest on the North American continent, as it happens, but that's just incidental.
We don't have to go back to the previous millennium. I have a couple of questions about terminology. You mentioned the term gentrifications in passing.
Yeah.
Is that a term that's used anywhere in a suburban context? In Africa, south of whatever, is a question. Because there's someone at University College London who's doing a survey of the meaning of, or the absence of, the global south in the gentrification discourse, and so I'm kind of curious about that. And the other question is, you were talking at the very end there about the suburbs of Abidjan, and I'm wondering, I mean, how are those suburbs referred to locally?
Yes.
Obviously they use, well, I assume, French language terminology, but I mean, is it Faubourg, or is it banlieue, or is it something completely different?
Mm-hmm. Maybe we should collect some thinking rather than me going there.
If you prefer that,
yep.
You can do that.
I have a couple of questions. Can you please expand your last point in the conclusion, the meaning of centrality, how you redefine? I mean, you were very brief, and I think I understood it, but I would like to have a little bit more detail. Mm. And then the other point that I also would like you to expand a little bit about the point of urban spatial expansion going up, particularly in the context of my own work here,
right.
The condo boom, of course, this is a point that I find very intriguing, so if you could expand a little bit on this.
Cool. Thank you.
Dean and Shubra.
Hi.
Yes, now I know, yeah.
I have a question about, in some sense it's a methodological question, some of the things you started with and ended with. I was really impressed that the enormous amount of information and complexity that you're trying to deal with. I mean, all those cities in Africa, number of people is really amazing. I'm wondering whether, I mean, my question really is about whether there's a category called African cities or African suburbs, and whether, other than in a geographical sense, whether there's something that African cities and suburbs have that are more common among them than with the other places in the world. So, I mean, I think at the end, when you talk about those three emphases that you're going to be looking at, that maybe that's where that commonality could begin.
Thank you. Provocative.
That connects with Jean's question. I'm Shubhra Gurani. I'm the Department of Anthropology and part of the Global Civilization Project, and I work in India, North India. In terms of thinking, I mean, I have two questions. One was, I mean, what are these local categories you've been interested in? And I'm thinking, it's a relational category that you're showing that, you know, as the trash between Dakar and the Tuba, they can extend. These are constantly shifting, and I think it's very familiar in other sites also. So the local categories are also shifting. What it means to be a city dweller, or what does city exactly mean, is a moving target. And I was thinking that peri-urban, for instance, planners and English-speaking people may use in India, but it's not a category that circulates. Urban is completely alien in that context. So what people use is an interesting question, but one has to move beyond that. My other question to you was, in terms of you showed your point about what is bringing about this change, and it is a significant large investment that are coming from outside. Are these kind of maps and plans, I mean, the zone which you showed, the map of the Accra Mall, I mean, they're so familiar. I mean, they're so familiar. There's a huge investment. So there's a whole army of planners, it seems, or, who are doing this. I mean, many of this could be anywhere in,
absolutely.
In India. And I think that kind of similarity is interesting, but they're not necessarily structurally or historically the same. So I think that is an interesting... so that map that you showed is exactly what I have in my computer, which could be a place where one could think about who's generating these maps. So, I mean, or the public housing, I mean, it's interesting how their trajectories have been formed. So I was wondering, do you know anything about these planners or architects who are designing these? I mean, the companies who are hiring them? Because these glass-plated high-rises is exactly the vision of the modern India is now getting coded. So I don't know if you have any... She's consolidating the idea of the city in its own way.
You know, the biggest question, I think the two biggest lacks that we have in what we've written here so far, and I know most of you haven't seen this, some of you got it yesterday because that's when we got around to sending it out. I know I'll hear back from you, and I look forward to that. I think the two biggest immediate lacunae, the two biggest gaps are, number one, that we haven't, as I started to say, engaged with what people are saying conceptually about the meaning of the urban changes, or city changes that are going on in India, in Latin America, in China, in Indonesia, and in Africa, and the destabilizations which have been introduced. And I mentioned the name of Ananya Roy as much as anything else, just as a kind of way of saying that I'm referring to a cloud of work that's going on around there, which is particularly provocative and very elegantly articulated. So I want to say that first, because I think when we do engage, when we come back to this and try and write a version of this for Amsterdam, which I suppose is the next version we have to produce, that we are successfully, and I think it's in doing that that some of the questions that have been raised will surface in new ways. For example, the centralities question, I think, is going to surface in a whole lot of new ways as we do that. So I may not have any very satisfactory answers to questions that you've raised right now. These are all of you, Jean, Uta, you've all raised very, very, very big, difficult questions, actually. So for which thank you, but I don't necessarily have something simple to say. Second lacuna, however, is we don't ever really get down to saying, are we comfortable or not with using the term suburb across all of this stuff? Are we just being driven by a project that has a website called Global Suburbs or something like that? Or what is our view on that subject? And I guess we will have to arrive at a little bit more of a view on that subject as we proceed. And I say that because quite a number of the comments that you've made are about terminology, not just yours, Shubhra, although it's one of your two points is very much in that area. So let me just very quickly then be a bit... I don't have a view on that at the moment. Sometimes I feel, I wake up in the morning and I think, no, we're going to chuck out the way we've done this paper. We're going to say it's nonsense to use one term to cover all this stuff. But by the time I go to bed again, my brain's got exhausted thinking about how we're going to do that. I'm thinking, yeah, we do need something. There is something there. And that's what Richard has made this very eloquent attempt to grapple with, which is to try to tease meanings globally from the question of suburb. And we say here, Richard will have seen this, we have to go a little bit further with that exercise. And I think that's something that we need to do. So, yes, gentrification, to use that specific, coming on the, just a little list of terms here, gentrification definitely in older areas of, I mean, people in Harare would specifically use, they wouldn't all be people teaching at the university who would specifically use, University of Zimbabwe does still function, just in case you're worried about that, by the way. I have a very wonderful PhD student there, who's not working on suburbs, however. Gentrification without doubt in Avondale in Harare, people would say, yeah, look at this, there was a sort of an arrested process of gentrification because when the economy fell on the lean times of the last 10 or 15 years. So yeah, terms are widely used. Whether we can, we will not succeed in standardizing the way in which those terms are used. There's no way this project, it will influence the way some people think, there's no doubt about that, but we're not going to change the way in which people use words in Africa. Our job is more to say, for us, this is the way we're using these terms, and this is how we see those terms relating to the way others are also using those terms, to try and bring, we have to try and bring some order. That may be a very modernist thing to say, but we have to try and bring some order to our reflections here. And in a way, you're all asking for that. So that's my way of dealing, rather than being more specific and going on at more length, that's my way of dealing with terminological questions, except for Jean's point about the African city. You can come to Montreal, if you like, on Tuesday, because my invitation to Montreal is to do a thing on Tuesday under the title, this is for Julian and these people, under a title like, I don't know, the dynamics of change of cities in Africa or some such grandiose thing that nobody in the world is qualified to talk about, definitely not me. But in that paper, which is the chapter of one of my supposed book manuscripts, the first question is this: in what way does Africa have cities? And that's the question that you're asking. And I don't have, I mean, that chapter is about not answering that question, really, as is often the case with an introduction. And yet, I think as I've read this literature, and I think that is an interesting point to ponder, and that's a question I would ask Shubhra, for example, of you, Richard, coming more recently to studies of historical stuff, especially in India. India is a very large and diverse concept in its own right. Indian cities are not only large in each of their own rights, but enormously varied and diverse. In what way does India have cities that have things in common? What are the commonalities, and to what extent are they things that we say are Indian as opposed to something else? Those are superficial questions at one level, but in other ways they could be turned into something quite profound. And that's how I would come back to Uta's point about centralities, because I don't have much to say on that. I think what we have to do is we, to use the old-fashioned you know, not to use the Ed Soger might say to deconstruct, whereas Peter Marcuse would say unpack. We have to do something with that term, and I think that's what we've started trying to do. First of all, bouncing off the literature and saying this is how people are thinking about centralities. But especially in the African case, and this is my last comment on this group of comments and questions, in the African case, the point that I made first, and perhaps I didn't, you can never overstress it, because the fluidity of population in Africa is, you know, it's let's just say, it's a lot. It's extreme. It's very large. It's very unusual to find people who don't have live connections, who may have been living in the city their whole life, but they have live connections with people who are living in countrysides, is the loose phrase that we introduce in this piece of writing, with an enormous amount of flux between those environments. And everybody who's predicted that in the long term these things will diminish as Africa becomes like Texas or something like that, doesn't really seem to happen, you know? So what is central in the lives of those people, those hundreds of millions of people that I've just collapsed into one tiny paragraph and a half here? What is centrality in the lives of those people? Well, it's clearly not just something inside the bounds, whatever those are, of the city. What is urban and rural? That's why I started by reading that Paul Jenkins, very sensitive guy. You know, that's why I started by reading those things. So I think you're driving me to shut up here. I think what you're driving me to say is we do need to explore that sort of point.
I think this is absolutely critically important to a particular group of people here in this in this room. A lot of the people in this room will go to Germany later this summer to look at a particular kind of built form which
I didn't answer the density.
To a particular state, to the state of East Germany, central to meeting its housing needs. And they redefine centrality, also influenced by the Marxist adage of dissolving the contradiction between the city and the countryside, which we should never forget was a very important aspect of 19th and 20th century thinking. The idea of dissolving centrality into a new momentum which hadn't existed before in capitalist and feudal forms of urbanization. So they built housing estates in or close to rural agricultural landscapes. And yesterday, when many of us went downtown and heard two people speak eloquently and show images of two very different historical instances of that example of building those housing estates. Now, we see those housing estates also in the outskirts of Dar es Salaam, built by the same German architects that were built. They built those housing estates that many of you will be visiting this summer and will be spending time in to understand what's going on. What I'm wondering then is whether the particular built form plays a role, and I need to correct you in one thing, that the straitjacket that our project is putting on, the terminological straitjacket, is not about suburbs, it's about suburbanisms.
Yeah.
And it's a plural. And so what I'm wondering is to what degree the building of these particular landscapes have an influence on the suburbanisms, and then to come back to Simone and you and the people who are talking about performativity and for performing urban life. That's what Abdelmalek Simon talks about. You know, to talk about different ways of living. There's an interesting debate in the current International Journal issue about life itself, about how you live life, in these forms. Whether we can, you know, actually continue to believe that certain types of built environments have an influence on the way in which we live, because a lot of people grew up in single-family home suburbs, were kept, and today's marketing of those suburbs here in North America are built on the assumption that if you move there, you can live a certain life, and you're subscribing to a lifestyle. If you live in another type of house or building, like in an apartment building, you subscribe to another type of suburbanism. So the question is whether we look at, when we look at these buildings, whether they're in, you know, in the examples that you showed between, you know, as different as Tunisia on the one hand and Dar es Salaam on the other hand, high-rise buildings, for example, whether living in those buildings, and Simone's example are in Phnom Penh, for example, whether living in these buildings makes you live a particular suburban lifestyle, which is universal in some degree, because it's the same in East Germany as it is in Toronto, as it is in Dar es Salaam, because the form pushes itself onto your performance, or whether you can see markedly different ways in which these lifestyles are being performed, despite the fact that they happen in the same types of containers. So I've just now taken your question and turned it around and say, you know, is there an African form of suburbanism? But are there different kinds of universal suburbanisms that we recognize in the single family home suburbs of Sandton or the, you know, wherever, you know, the rich people live now in Johannesburg, that are similar to people in California and similar to people in north of Toronto? And it's more important to tease out those similarities in those forms of performed suburban life than it is to say there's an African suburbanism, an Indian suburbanism, a Polish suburbanism.
Can I say something? My name is Wad Brankal, actually. I'm a planner. Mm-hmm. And I've worked in most cities in the Middle East. Not familiar with Africa, but certainly North Africa. And really, I mean, between the two comments, I wanted to add something. It's really a question about who also participate, or the key people that participate in shaping the fabric and order. And I'm talking from my experience as a planner working on most cities in the Middle East. Names come to my mind that actually are mainly developers, like Mahir, Al-Fotain was building Dubai. We call it Dubaization, actually, the Middle East city. Building a festival city in Dubai and building one in the suburbs of Cairo at the same time. Actually, I was in Tripoli 2 months before actually this unfortunate event started to take place. And I was looking at the coast there, and it's another scene from Dubai. Qatari companies are actually building the coast. And those actually developers, to me, more or less, are important key players in really shaping cities. So these are key player. And the other key player, to be honest with you, the firms that I work for, which are more or less Western firms doing planning in many of these areas. And we go there, and I can be blamed for that, but we go there with them, and we say, oh, the first thing we need to do is really, we need to know what this means. We draw a line on the map that defines the urban edge. That's it. This is urban areas, and actually all policies should be directed where all the native, the future building should take place inside the cities. I've seen this in so many cities, to the level that actually, whatever the term you want to use about for the edge, to the level that edge over a period of 10 years has been transformed into really a completely different space shaped by a line on the map. So, this also, to me, part of the commonality between several cities. And I'm not sure how does it apply in really an African city. But I can tell you that the firm I worked for in the past used to build or used to put together resettlement plans for mining companies,
yep,
which functioned in many of these cities. And that particular firm participated in really shaping many of these cities simply by remodeling or building housing for labor. I don't know if there's a question here.
But it's a very, you know, I think you're. It's a useful corrective in the sense that I don't think I ever used the term developer or planner or designer or any of those terms in what I was talking about, partly because that's so close to some of what has been part of my own trade in my own life. But I'm not going to put it for it now, but those of you who've got access to the paper, you'll see there's a nice little quote about the planning of the Accra Mall and how this came about, and how a kind of a chance meeting between the guy who had bought the land like 50 years ago, or somehow acquired, let's assume generously that he bought the land, which was then countryside, outside Accra, whatever that might mean, then always wanted to do some interesting development. The airport grew up, an old British military base, obviously, very typical post-British colonialism. The airport grew up as an international airport. Things started to happen. He could see the value in this land. That's why he had got his hands on it in the first place. But he didn't have the capital to make it go until he ran into one of the, probably the largest, South African supermarket chain looking for opportunities. And it doesn't have to be South African in this instance. It was. It might have been from Botswana, a country that has money to export. Or it might have been from India or from somewhere else in another African city context. And this chance meeting led to the development of a shopping mall. As soon as the second anchor tenant came in, and that those two could persuade the developer to come in, they could raise the money, buy the concrete, get the building, get the construction firm, the engineers, the architects, and everybody else involved. And out of that comes the plan that stands at the entrance when you walk into the mall, which might as well be in Mlimani instead of Accra in Dar es Salaam, or apparently in Bangalore, or whatever the case may be. So you're absolutely right to emphasize those elements, whether it's in Karachi or anywhere else. We haven't done justice here because we haven't yet gone into sufficiently grey areas of literature. We've been focusing on the academic literature so far. I should have said that to begin with. And there's not very much in the academic literature which helpfully explores beyond the relatively straightforward things we can say in this room at the moment. And we need to go into the stuff which is in the other kinds of material, which will help us to explore, not including questions like, where have people actually made money and not made money? Where have they made more money and made less money? Those are the kinds of questions which we're completely naive about presently. I'm really delighted that you made that.
I'm afraid, even though we've just really scratched the surface of this debate on this very rich paper, that we have to end it here, because there are two things that have to happen, which is he has to, our globally mobile intellectual has to be having drinks tonight in Vancouver, to be back in Montreal on Tuesday, as we heard. So you have the time, if you want, get on a train. There's actually buses these days, we don't have any trains in Montreal. Get on a train, you know, just leisurely go to Montreal, you'll catch up with it. And you can hear what he has to say about African City Tuesday. So that's one thing he has to catch his plane. The other thing is that I know there is a class taking place, and I think if I'm right, you're staying here, right? So stay here. So what I'm going to do is I make sure that he gets on his cab. I'm going to come back here. And all of you, after a break, will continue. I mean, the ones that are part of the Leipzig adventure. Oh, it starts at 3. So you have a bit of time, go have a coffee, and so
on. We can show.
So please join me once again in thanking Alan for this.
Thank you to all of you. Thanks to you.
Thank you.
I didn't thank you for the hotel.
And could I please ask the members of the steering committee of our project to assemble in this corner for a group photograph?
Perfect. I was just going to suggest that.
Quite a good idea.
I'll take one with both here.
I'm not really a member of this team.